I'm holding a book that right from the first glance intrigued me on several levels. First, it was the cover of the blues and the white with gold strips cutting through. Secondly, the title of the book that isn't even on the front cover but printed on the side, The Library of Ice. And then the wording on the front cover. Tracks on the ice are considered a better way of telling hunting stories than any words. Even their disappearance is part of the story, an indication of time passing as the hunter and the hunted move on. When the last of the ice has melted, the records of the past will be the least of our concerns. Well, as many of us here in the Southern Hemisphere are about to take a summer break, by contrast, we're set now to explore the Library of Ice with Nancy Campbell. Her words, those marvellous words, the ice, the preserver of human history. Nancy's a poet, a writer and an art critic, and she spent 7 years in artists in residences attached to Arctic research institutions in places like Greenland, Iceland and Switzerland. That time resulted in a variety of artistic endeavours inspired by the icy environment. And her book, Library of Ice, Readings in a Cold Climate, is likewise a result of that time. Nancy, a big welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much for having me. It's lovely to be able to talk to you.
You want to learn, you say, what words the ice could teach you. Now, was this before you went north, the reason why you wanted to stay in Arctic research institutions, or was it inspired after your first experience in Greenland?
I must admit, I first went north because I was very intrigued by the dark. I just finished a book of short book of poems about light and all the science behind light. And I was offered this position at a museum, the most northern museum in the world, in fact, during the dead of winter when it's dark 24 hours a day. So I thought how amazing it would be as a writer to experience that dark for the imagination. But once I arrived, and once it started to get a bit lighter and I could actually see the ice around me, I realised that it was so very intriguing. And I knew that the only way I could grow to understand it was to see how different cultures named it.
Well, yes, but it's conceptually the words the ice could teach you. Like initially I thought, what on earth is she talking about? Until I read further. So is this part of a metamorphosis that has occurred in you?
I think it certainly changed me enormously. My experience on this very small island with 800 people, living alongside hunters who are risking their lives every day to go out onto the changing ice to find food, made me realise how sort of temporal and precious life is. And I think I wanted to understand the ice because it seemed to me that it had a changing story and that it could tell us about our own history as humans. Well, I was really fascinated by the ice cores, actually.
I was going to come to the ice cores later, but tell us, because that was another totally challenging moment for me, reading about the ice cores. Tell us more, please.
Well, the ice core is a technique that's been used by scientists recently. They can drill down into the ice cap using the same technique that you use for drilling for oil, ironically, and discover the ancient ice, because the ice at the bottom of the ice cap is many, many years old. In fact, in Antarctica, the most historic ice core goes back 240,000 years, the one drilled at Vostok. So that's older than any human records that writers have made. And it fascinated me that you can actually read, if you're a scientist, in the layers of ice, all the different climatic conditions the world has ever known. So I think that's what lies behind the title of my book, actually. The original library is actually one that's made of ice.
Now, the language of ice includes all the words for ice from the various indigenous languages, but also a rather large glossary of words to describe different types of ice. And it's important for those people navigating the ice on ships or submarines or fisher people, as you say. This is the glossary of sea ice nomenclature, which might all seem rather amusing, but it really does mean life or death when you're there, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You need to know exactly what you're standing on or sailing through. I found these dictionaries really fascinating as someone who, going north for the first time, not really being able to understand what I was seeing, although it was beautiful and I was appreciating it. I really found the knowledge in these books very useful. So the Dictionary of Sea Ice Nomenclature is in four languages, Russian, French, Spanish, and English. And it's used by everyone who navigates the seas around the Arctic and Antarctic. And I'm a bit of a word geek, so I loved finding out all about the different sizes of icebergs and how they're categorized. And lovely phrases like pancake ice, which really does look like pancakes, small round segments of ice that bump up against each other.
And tell us some of the other categories, please.
Well, there's Nylas, which is kind of spiky ice, and you also get quite greasy ice, which is when it's first forming on the sea and you can barely see it. I find it fascinating, actually. It's just you see the dark water, and if you didn't know, you wouldn't know there was anything there, but there's just a thin film of cold as the ice is beginning to form. And that's one of the things I love about ice, actually. It's such a fluid, well, it's not fluid, it's solid, but it's such a changeable state, and you can watch its own narrative taking shape.
Well, there's a phrase, aukarnik, is it? A-U-K-K-A-R-N-E-Q. Open water in sea ice formed by a fast-moving current under the ice, open area or crack. Dangerous. Like, they get to real gradations and incredible specifics, do they, in order to be able to discern the danger?
Yes, certainly. And it's very important for the people working on the ice, and certainly the indigenous languages of the Arctic, which I've encountered, really do emphasize ice as it relates to people. So there's a word for ice that might cut your dog's feet. So you have a real sense of how people are traveling across the ice. And also terms for ice of different ages as well. So ice, multi-year ice, or ice that has come from further north. So the story of ice is all there in those languages.
And there are patterns, you say, as well. Patterns and sounds in the ice.
Yes, indeed there are. It's very important, I think, that the knowledge that's in these languages is preserved. And one of the impulses behind the dictionaries that are now being printed is because so much of this traditional knowledge may be in danger of being lost, or with the globalization of scientific languages like English. So it's very important that everyone has access to these languages, not just the original speakers, but scientists too can find all these terms really useful.
So is science tending to come in and trump the accumulated knowledge, is it, that has been handed down verbally?
I think maybe there was a time in the long distance past when that might have been the case, but I think now science is very much recognizing the value of traditional knowledge, whether that's the language or the, you know, the awareness of people who might be living on site and have many stories and much experience of the area.
As I said, you spent time in artist-in-residence programs, and one of those was in northwest Greenland, and you lived in a museum said to be the most northernmost museum in the world. And on some days, the building is almost completely buried under snow. Now, how did you find it? I mean, was it forbiddingly cold?
I was lovely and warm, actually. I borrowed clothes before I went away from everyone I knew who went skiing. And also the islanders were so friendly and welcoming and gave me many things like gloves and hats. So I had almost, I was almost too warm. The houses, the little wooden houses are incredibly cozy. And I sort of loved wrapping up and going outside. And snow is quite warm, really, you know, if you're buried in it, it's quite warm. You can make snow caves and traditional housing in the north, not anymore, but traditionally igloos are made of snow. So snow is definitely something that people welcome.
Yes, indeed. The whole discussion that you introduced me to of ice harvesting and the thriving international businesses that resulted from, I think, a man called Frederick Tudor, who first harvested ice from Walden Pond in Massachusetts when Henry David Thoreau was living by the pond. So, I mean, that's another whole aspect of ice that I don't think certainly Australians would know much about.
I wonder if he probably never sent it as far as Australia. That might have been a little too ambitious. But I was fascinated the way different cultures had approached ice. And I started off looking at a great hero of mine, Henry Thoreau, who lived in a solitary, like me in a cabin, but not by the side of the Baffin Sea, by the side of Walden Pond. And he was such a great naturalist and writes beautifully about his snowy walks. And then reading his journals, I discovered that on one of his walks, he passed this industrious team of workers who were taking the ice away from the surface of these ponds, and discovered this fascinating story of the ice trade. I mean, what an entrepreneur Frederick Tudor was to believe that he could send ice around the world. And he ended up shipping ice to Calcutta, a long journey, half of it melted, but he made a fortune on the back of that trade.
Yes, indeed. And that led into the discussion around housing, which is what intrigued me, that ice houses that I presume you're describing slowly slipped out of use with the warming climate at the end of the 19th century. And then, of course, refrigeration came in.
Mm-hmm. So really, it's relatively recently that this rather obscure bit of vernacular architecture slipped out of use. And I got fascinated by these tiny, often beehive-shaped buildings, which certainly rich people would have in their grounds. I find the ice houses very, very intriguing. And in a sense, my book is also about home and the planet as our home. And so I suppose the idea that these little buildings were actually also called houses intrigued me, the fact that people had built houses for their ice.
And in fact, you say there's a campaign to preserve ice houses.
There is, yes. People realise that they're an important aspect of British culture. And, we're so reliant on electricity these days. To me, it seems impossible, the thought of not having a fridge. But I like the fact that humans have the resources to be able to preserve things like ice for their drinks, even if we didn't have access to electricity.
Now, you do say this ice being the preserver of human history, offering glimpses of different ways of living. There are artefacts lying undiscovered, aren't there, when archaeologists are discovering this in Greenland, seeing it as an open-air museum. The artefacts going right back to the Vikings. And I just wonder whether, in fact, the locals like uncovering this, or whether they feel it's slightly sacrilegious that things should stay sort of quiet.
You know, that's such an interesting question. I did find when I was working in the museum in Greenland that although I was officially, my role was to write about the museum and its collections, which were anthropological, so a lot of tools and objects of daily life. Even though that was my focus, the museum assistant, Greta, said that I should be looking more at the island and the landscape, and she was encouraging me to look away from the museum and the objects it's held. And likewise, with the objects that are found under the ice, maybe they're not so important as the living landscape in terms of a Greenlandic identity.
And I found it interesting, in terms of the current state, what you write about the numbers of scientists increasingly talking with some of the elders in the area who've lived in the Arctic region and who can describe the changes they've detected due to climate change. For example, you quote a man called Peter Elachik, speaking of the changes in the snow. In the 1940s, snow was very hard and dry, and you could hear footsteps 30 metres away. Now, because of the moisture, you don't hear footsteps. Did you see firsthand changes in the Arctic people's lifestyles because of changes in the ice?
I did, yes. I wouldn't say see, because I couldn't really tell the difference between what was there before, but I certainly observed their anxiety about climate change. And I was lucky, because I had a sort of official position on the island, I got to meet a lot of people and indeed have many dinners with the islanders and talk quite seriously about these issues. And Upernavik is very far north, so it's always had a lot of sea ice around it. And the real concern in the February of the year that I was there was that the ice was unstable and unpredictable, and people were not leaving the island as they usually did with their dog teams, because they were afraid the ice would collapse beneath them. So not only is there a break in tradition there, there's also an inability to find food. And one of the things that I found most poignant when I was told it was that the hunters are worried that they may have to shoot their dog teams because they are unable to feed them. They cannot catch the meat to feed them. And the bond between a hunter and his dogs you know, it's very close, it's family. So this sort of dilemma is terrible and really tragic. So in a way, for me to experience that as someone, you know, who's been lucky enough to spend most of my life using the world's resources and contributing to this situation, it really gave me pause for thought and made me seriously consider what ways I could, you know, make a tiny difference to my lifestyle.
Well, certainly I detect awe in your writing about it, which is what is very captivating. I wonder how much it did change you. 7 years, basically, you devoted to these various residences. People thought you were mad, but in fact, I think you discovered a silence there that others said was available. But how did it alter you?
I think it changed me very much as a writer. It gave me my subject in a way. I discovered so much about the environment. And I think it made me have a sense of how important the earth is as our home. And I was looking at the root for the word eco, which we use so much about, you know, ecology or anything relating to the environment. And I realized that the root of the word ecology is eco or home. And it made me really have a sense of the importance of seeing the world as our home.
Well, thank you very much indeed. It's one of the more unusual topics that I've heard, and I mean that in a complimentary fashion in terms of how it's affected me reading it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And Nancy's book is called The Library of Ice, Readings from a Cold Climate. It's published by Scribner.